From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Immigration has become a centerpiece in Georgia's Republican gubernatorial primary.
As governor, I'll stop sanctuary cities.
I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals.
We're going to implement my 287G deportation plan that's going to fill this bus with illegals.
This morning, the Break Room Gang is going to weigh in on some controversial campaign ads from the gubernatorial candidates. We'll also talk about the royal wedding, because everybody else is, and whether we need a PG-15 rating. All that and more is ahead this hour, but first, recently, we broke down how executive orders work and how they've long been used to prove presidential power for better or worse.
We are setting a standard for the rest of the world in the treatment of people who may have loyalties to an enemy nation. We are protecting ourselves without violating the principles of Christian decency.
That's Milton Eisenhower. He oversaw the imprisonment of Japanese Americans during World War II. The authority for it came from an executive order of President Franklin Roosevelt, and here are your first thoughts. Jose Malabo writes, I had no idea the internment of Japanese Americans came as a result of an executive order. That was a topic of heated debate many moons ago at a family Thanksgiving dinner. Thanks for your comment, Jose. We also got this voicemail.
Hello, I'm calling from Roswell, Georgia, and I prefer not to give my name because it might affect my staying in the U.S. I'm a psychologist, fully licensed in Georgia, with a specialty in the treatment of PTSD. I've been here legally treating American citizens, renewing my visa over several years. My visa was granted because of my specialty in treating PTSD. I am not from one of the countries that President Trump included in his executive order banning travel from certain countries. In fact, I am from a country that the U.S. has traditionally labeled a friend and long-term trading partner. But I am concerned that if I leave the country for professional training or a family event, I will not be allowed to return. I cannot take the risk of leaving and being denied reentry, thus abandoning my patients.
Thank you for your voicemail, caller. Catherine Knapp Kina from Savannah writes us on Facebook, I'm old enough to have had real civics in high school, and I'm a fan of presidential biographies, so I have a pretty good knowledge of executive orders. I think civics has mostly been abandoned as far as I can see. Only elite AP students learn anything about the Constitution. Well, listeners, we always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. This year's flu season was awful. The most recent data from the Georgia Department of Public Health shows that 146 influenza-related deaths happened in the state over the course of the last year. Flu season is now over, but that doesn't mean we can ignore the topic. This year marks a century, 100 years since the Spanish flu of 1918 that killed at least how many? 50 million people worldwide, including some 675,000 in the United States. A new book on this deadly pandemic is out this week. It's called More Deadly Than War, and I'm joined by its author, Kenneth C. Davis. Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning, Adam. A great pleasure to be with you. And I would first say that that 50 million estimate has been doubled by many authorities.
Really?
On this question. Yeah, it could have been as many as 100 million worldwide, which is an astonishing number by itself, but it was also 5% of the world population at the time, which gives it an even more staggering dimension.
Incredible. How did you get on this topic?
I got on this topic because I've been writing about hidden history for a long time, starting with Don't Know Much About History nearly 30 years ago, and more recently with books about slavery in the White House, for instance, In the Shadow of Liberty. I've always tried to find those stories that the textbooks leave out, the untold pieces of our history that are too important to be ignored. And More Deadly Than War and the story of the Spanish flu and its connection specifically to the First World War, which was also going on, of course, 100 years ago, it was too powerful a story to ignore, especially because it speaks to so much of what's happening today. And that's the reason we study history. And there's no better example of that, I suppose, than your NPR headline at the top of the hour,
yeah.
That there's an outbreak of Ebola in Africa. These things should worry us.
What'd they call it, the Spanish flu?
That's an interesting connection to World War One. Spain, it most certainly did not originate in Spain, but Spain was a neutral country during World War One. Its newspapers were uncensored, unlike newspapers in most of the other combatant countries. So when the flu hit Madrid around this time, May of 1918, 100 years ago, the king was sick. So many people in Madrid were sick that they shut down the streetcars. The news was published. A release came out about an epidemic of unknown origin. And the connection to Spain was instantly made, at least in the English press, because when you look around the rest of the world, and this was a global pandemic that touched every part of the world, the flu had different names. The Germans called it the Bolshevik pest. The Russians called it the German pest. It was called the Black's disease in white South Africa and the white disease in black South Africa. But Spanish flu is kind of the name that has stuck historically to the chagrin of Spain.
I bet. Your book is called More Deadly Than War, because that's literally true, I suppose. The number of people killed by the Spanish flu far larger than the number of people, or at least combatants, killed by World War One. But I wonder if the Spanish flu wasn't in some way a result of World War One. All of the global travel taking place as part of the war, is that what spread it around the world?
Absolutely. And that's why I've twinned these stories of these two catastrophes together. There's no question that the Spanish flu was very bad, very virulent, very deadly, but that the wartime conditions hastened and expanded its spread far beyond any single geographical location. And the best example of that is the fact that even though it certainly did not begin in an army base in Kansas, that was where one of the first recorded cases was. These were bases that were set up in 1917 when the United States entered the war, and there were dozens of them around the country, including Camp Gordon just outside of Atlanta, where tens of thousands of young Americans were being trained to head off to a dreadful trench warfare of Europe. Over the course of that time, in March of 1918, there was an outbreak within those camps. Those soldiers then were loaded onto railroad cars, again crowded together, put onto crowded troop transports, and landed in France. There's no question that the arrival of nearly 1 million doughboys, as they were known, in France in the spring of 1918 contributed and accelerated the spread of this flu around the world. And from there, it went to other ports, because ships carrying soldiers, ships carrying medical supplies, were making their way around the globe. And within weeks, this not only became an American and then a European problem, but a global problem that, as we mentioned, killed perhaps 100 million people. You mentioned the deaths in the war. 675,000 Americans died in about the space of a year, a little more, perhaps. That's more than all of the Americans who died in World War One, World War Two, Korea and Vietnam combined. If we had that level of death today in America from the flu, we'd have to triple it by about three times because of the population. So we'd be talking about close to 2 million, if not more, people dying in a short space of time from the flu. As you mentioned, we had a bad flu season. Typically in a bad flu season, we have about 50,000 flu deaths. This was 675,000. To give you another perspective, that's about the same number of people who have died from HIV/AIDS over 30 years, but which disease obviously attracts much more attention and knowledge and information. So that's why it's important to understand how dreadful and deadly this war, this disease was coming in the midst of the war, and what tremendous impact it had on American society at the time.
We're talking with author Kenneth C. Davis. His new book is called More Deadly Than War. It's about the Spanish flu of 1918, which happened 100 years ago. This year killed upwards of 100 million, apparently, people worldwide, including several of my ancestors I know, and probably several of yours if you're listening. It's a good chance of it. You look back, Kenneth, to something like the Black Death in Europe, bubonic plague, you know, things that wiped out huge percentages of the population in Europe and in Asia. You know, bubonic plague is a bacterial disease. If it came up, in this year, they'd just give everybody antibiotics and nothing would happen. What do you think would have happened if the Spanish flu, if that particular strain of viral influenza had hit the population today? Would it be as devastating?
Well, of course, we have a lot more safeguards in place. We know, for instance, what a virus is. They did not know what a virus is in 1918. Microscopes were not yet powerful enough to see a virus, which is infinitesimally smaller than a bacteria. Bacteria had been seen. There were treatments for certain bacterial diseases. Cholera had been addressed in the understanding of how cholera was spread. Smallpox, of course, had been addressed for many, many years with vaccines and vaccinations, very different from what we think of as the vaccination today. So there was a limited degree of knowledge about what a virus was and how it affected. Many people thought that this was a bacteria, and they tried to treat it as if it were bacterial pneumonia, and none of those treatments were effective. Of course, we know today still there's no cure for the common cold or the flu, but we have a lot of medications that can treat the symptoms, ease the symptoms, certainly fever reducers. About the only drug that was available in 1918 was aspirin, introduced about 17 years earlier by Bayer, a German company, and that's significant. Bayer was accused, when this started breaking out, Bayer was accused of tainting the drug. There were accusations in the press, and this is where we get into the fake news of the era.
Indeed.
There were accusations that this disease had come from the Germans, that U-boats had poisoned the water somehow, or that Bayer had tainted its drugs. Bayer took out ads in 1918 saying that it was the drug was made in America on the banks of the Hudson, very famously one ad, made in America by Americans. So that's part of the story as well, that there was a tremendous amount of misinformation, fear, propaganda. And that's one of the pieces of this story that I think it's important for us to understand today.
In the last 30 seconds that we have here, Kenneth, you write in your book that the flu had an impact on the social structure of the United States and the world, particularly with regard to women's rights.
Absolutely. You know, after the war, there was this period of tremendous isolationism, and the war was part of that, but also the flu was part of that. We brought society in on itself. On the other hand, hundreds of thousands of women had, in many cases, volunteered to become nurses and go to the front lines or to go to work in factories in World War I, just as they would later on in World War II. That changed the role of women in society markedly, and it's no coincidence that the suffrage amendment is passed right after the flu and the war with the 19th Amendment.
That's Kenneth C. Davis, author of the new book, More Deadly Than War, about the 1918 Spanish flu killed upwards of 100 million people worldwide, and it happened 100 years ago this year. Kenneth, thank you so much.
Thank you. Just a reminder that walls don't stop viruses. Thanks a lot.
Indeed. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Paula Poundstone is a comedian, actor, and author, but public radio listeners know her best for her wit and her candor as a panelist on NPR's weekly news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Poundstone performs at the Miller Theater in Augusta at 8 o'clock tonight. She spoke with my colleague, Virginia Prescott, ahead of the show. Here's Virginia.
Well, you're known for taking issue with the results of some social science research, let's say, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And you're talking about, you know, the study of animals and what we find out about how they behave. You're not an anti-science person, obviously.
Oh, no, not at all. I love science, and I value science, and I'm sorry to see, you know, the idea that our scientists have to hide their data from the government. It just, you know, sort of chokes me with rage. No, science is very important.
But you have tested some very unscientific studies on the search for human happiness. This is the part of the title of your book about testing theories to the key to happiness. Now, what did you find?
My book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, is a series of experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy.
Like what?
I think the classic sort of American idea of what would make one happy, which isn't something I particularly believed in, but was, driving a fancy sports car. Like if you had a lot of money, you could do whatever you wanted. A lot of people would get a fancy sports car. So, my plan was to rent a sports car for a week until I realized that on the website I was looking at, those long numbers underneath weren't serial numbers, but rather were prices. and then I realized that I could not rent a sports car for a week because I didn't have that much money. But I did rent one for 24 hours.
Did it make you happy?
No. I drove the fastest car I will ever drive in Los Angeles, which is mostly bumper-to-bumper traffic. So, I was getting up to peak speeds of 2, 3, 4, 5 miles an hour. Right after I rented it in the evening and at about, I had gone to a class, and at like 11 o'clock at night, I was driving home from that class, and there's a little section of Wilshire Boulevard that really I enjoyed driving even in my dented van. But I have to say, in a fancy sports car, there's one section of Wilshire Boulevard through Westwood that's if it's late at night and no one else is there, that's actually sort of fun to drive.
So you kind of opened it up there?
Yeah, I did that. Yeah, that was my...
It's like 30 miles an hour?
That was maybe, 5 minutes? If that.
You're on your way to Augusta, Georgia. I don't even know if you can rent a Lamborghini or whatever kind of fancy sports car you're into there. What are you planning?
It was a Lamborghini. I'll have to just manage. I'll have to manage without my Lamborghini, which I did the following day when we looked out the window. We're like, how come our dented van is in my Lamborghini parking spot? I welcome... I look forward to going to Augusta, Georgia. Although, come on, that's fancy golf country. They've got to have fancy sports cars down there, right?
Yeah, I'm going to leave it to you to find that out.
Yeah. I'm concerned that I'm going to have to whisper my act while I'm in Augusta, Georgia because of the golf.
Yes, and everybody is going to have to clap very genteelly.
Yeah, because of the golf and wear just god-awful pants.
Well, Paula, you're somebody who has to notice what's going on in the world. You have been a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me more than 200 times. So how do you prep to be quizzed on the news?
In the week leading up to my Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me appearances, I buy copies of the New York Post. And because, for two reasons, I don't even use most of what's in there. And certainly editorially, I don't share their views, but it has a News of the Weird section. That's one reason.
And not to mention the headlines.
Yeah, I mean, it gets the broad strokes of the stories. But the truth is, on Wait, Wait, what usually trips you up is the News of the Weird. I've always said to people, if you were to just go on and say... For every question you're asked, you say Afghanistan or Trump, you're going to do pretty good. And then just at the very end, throw in lemurs down his pants. And you're probably, you'll come in second out of three.
Well, you have been in the news yourself as the first woman to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Now, this was back in 1992. Now, what was that like?
They didn't make as big a fuss about that event back then as they do now. It certainly wasn't televised anywhere. And it was a fun event in general to be a part of, but it's not really a performer's dream, to be totally honest. I can't remember now. In 92, it was the first George Bush was president.
Right.
When I was asked to do it, I was asked by Charles Bierbauer, who was at CNN at the time, and he was the head of the White House Correspondents Association at the time. When he asked me, I was like, well, that's a terrible idea. It just didn't make any sense to me. I was like, well, I don't really see how that'll go over. And he said, no, I think you'll be fine. And I was very young, okay? I was very idealistic. So I said, all right, but I'm not, I'm a Democrat, and I don't support, George Bush, and I don't want anything to do with him, and I don't want to meet him, and I don't want pictures. And I was very resolute. And Charles Bierbauer, to his credit, didn't roll his eyes at me. He was just like, oh, okay. So the day the day before the dinner or the day of, I don't recall, I arrive at the hotel, and the message light is on the phone, and I call the front desk, and they say the White House is calling. And it turns out that the president had asked me to come to the White House to meet with him. Let me tell you, I could not stash my spine under my bed fast enough. I flew to the White House. I was there in a heartbeat. I was at the White House. And I met with the first George Bush. And I have to say, he was very charming and very kind. And he said ultimately, because finally I went, well, you must have asked me here for some reason, sir. And he said, well, the guy who did it last year was a little bit blue. And I wanted to make sure you weren't going to say anything, off color. And I said, well, I don't really do anything that falls into that category. And he said, okay, and then say whatever you want.
Wow. And did you?
I said what I had planned to say anyways. It didn't have, back then anyways, not to the best of my knowledge, it wasn't a roast. Nobody asked me to come roast the president or the press corps or anything like that. I just came and did a set. And I talked about George Bush. I told the crowd, I said, I did meet with him today, and he was charming. Unbelievably charming, by the way, magnetically charming in a way that I never would have predicted. And I said, and so I think he's a very nice man, and I wish him luck in the private sector. he was charming, and I didn't want him to be president. And I have to say, he chuckled politely, and as did the missus. She wrote me a very sweet note. It was all nice. It wasn't a roasty thing. It's a very strange event, by the way, at best. I don't know how it was. I mean, I think they first did it with like Calvin Coolidge or something, and I can imagine what a laugh fest that must have been. But it's an event that doesn't know what it is, which is why they stumble into problems constantly.
Well, there's been a lot of problems this year, obviously.
Yeah, but it's not, it's because the event is ill-defined. That's what the problem is. So no one quite knows what it is they're supposed to be doing. Is it a night of fundraising? Is it a night of awareness raising? Is it a night of camaraderie? Is it a night of entertainment? Is it a night of activism? Is it a night, it doesn't know what it is. And until they decide what it is, they're going to have problems every year.
That's comedian Paula Poundstone speaking with On Second Thoughts' Virginia Prescott. She performs tonight at 8 o'clock at Augusta's Miller Theater. You can also hear her regularly on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which airs tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock and Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on GPB Radio. Well, it's been another long week. We've talked about the gender pay gap, men's place in the hashtag MeToo movement, and the wonders of science fiction. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for The Break Room.
Fill this bus with illegals to send them back to where they came from. We're not just going to track them and watch them roam around our state. We're going to put them on this bus and send them home.
Laurel?
It's been like more Kardashian than a royal, this wedding so far. Absolutely chaotic.
Joining us in the break room to discuss those stories and more are Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, Greg Williams, host of the radio show Greg's List, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and new addition, comedian Niemer, who is in Atlanta this week to perform at the Punchline Comedy Club. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Morning, Adam.
Hey, Adam.
Howdy. So, among radio people like me, we often discuss a very discouraging to us law of media nature, which is that audio never goes viral. Except this week, praise be, it did. A few years ago, remember, the internet was divided about whether a certain dress was white or gold and black or blue or whatever. Now there's a fight about whether this voice recording is saying Laurel or Yanni. Some people say they can hear both. Let's hear what y'all hear. Let's play it.
Laurel. 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 Laurel.
Okay, let's go down the line. Natalie?
Laurel, Laurel, Laurel.
Greg?
Laurel.
Sumaya?
Laurel.
Niemer?
Mohammed. No, I'm
just, hey.
Just keep it interesting. It's Laurel. It's definitely clearly Laurel.
Yep.
Well, so here's the thing that's interesting is that it's if you look at it in a spectrograph, as I have, because that's the kind of thing that I would do, the upper frequencies are saying Yanni and the lower frequencies are saying Laurel. So that explains a couple of things. One, it explains why for some people in some listening environments, it's totally clearly Laurel Yanni, because different speakers have different frequency responses. And so like a tiny little iPhone speaker, if you're listening to it on a mobile device, is going to have a lot of upper frequency content. So you're going to get a lot of Yanni in there. The other thing is that if you look at it, women have been hearing Yanni much more than men have been hearing Yanni, and which is no surprise because women's ears are more attuned to upper frequencies. It's been speculated that the evolutionary reason for that is to be better able to be more sensitive
us?
To
babies
crying. Mommy, mommy, mommy,
yeah, exactly.
Mommy.
Tune out the men.
There's that.
We're on the lower frequencies. They tune us out. That's the whole point. We're so bad to women, they've literally isolated our frequency out.
And this is the first time Yanni has been trending in his entire life, right?
I know.
He was like, thanks for trending, man.
Did you see his tweet?
Yeah.
He tweeted out, he's like, I only hear Yanni.
And Laurel and Hardy were both obviously biased towards one, too. So.
Yes.
This has just been the best thing ever. This makes me so happy.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that's all there is to say about that. Let's talk about another thing of great consequence. Every wedding involves some family drama. The highly anticipated and endlessly hyped royal wedding of Prince Harry and American actress Meghan Markle is no different. Their marriage is this weekend. Meghan's half-siblings are said to be writing tell-all books, and they claim that she has always acted like a princess even before becoming one, although I think she's technically going to be a duchess. After much speculation about it, it's now confirmed that Meghan Markle's father is not going to walk her down the aisle. Apparently, there's some drama there. Natalie, I have just learned that you are a former British vice consul to the United States?
I used to be vice consul for Her Majesty's government here in Atlanta. That's correct.
Are you all a Twitter?
You know, I'm not as much into this wedding. I don't know why. I think it's just, I didn't know Meghan Markle before. Prince Harry's been kicking around causing interesting moments for a long time. But I do want to see what they wear, and I want to see the fascinators, the hats and fascinators.
What's a fascinator?
A fascinator is a hat without a brim that kind of perches on the side of your head, and nobody does it like the British. Oh my gosh! I mean, they will have these things that look like bull horns and nests of butterflies and all kinds of crazy things perching on their heads. So I'm in it for the headgear.
Sumaya, is it weird that we care about this?
It's a fairy tale. I mean, you know, Princess Grace, Queen Noor. This is the 21st century fairy tale for the American public, and looking forward to it.
Not just the American public, indeed. This is a global phenomenon to some degree.
Well, I agree.
Interesting. Yeah, Greg, are you all a Twitter about people's fascinators?
You know, I hate to bah humbug here, but I stopped caring about the marital and breeding habits of the royal family in 1776.
You know, you look pretty good for someone.
You look great.
100 years old.
You look great, yeah. Greg. That's what we should be talking about right now.
Octogenarian.
What's your secret?
Now?
Yeah.
What's your secret?
It is vodka. Yeah.
Niemer, I know that you are waking up early in the morning to watch this, right?
Yeah. I am. Okay. I'm going to be up super early. I live for wedding. I'm being very sarcastic. I'm I'm getting married soon myself.
Oh, and congratulations.
She's going to want a fascinator.
I'm doing is I'm making sure. I want her to be traveling on the dates of this. I don't want her to get inspired. You know what I'm saying? I'm Arab, and she might start feeling like a, you know, like a princess herself, and now we have to pay, you know, the men pay for the wedding. So as far as I'm concerned, anything that looks expensive, this fastener thing, she's never going to hear about it. More cost. All I'm seeing here is more cost.
Unless she's listening to this radio show.
Oh, no, I can guarantee you she's tuned out my frequency as well long ago.
She hears Laurel and Yanni. Nothing
I'm there. I'm just around.
Right. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. We are talking about the week's news here with our break room gang, which consists this week of Natalie Pavelski, Vice President of Cater Communications, Greg Williams, host of the radio show Greg's List, Samaya Khalifa, Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and the comic Namer. Am I saying that right, by the way?
Close. It's Nimmer. It's like Nimmer. It's like Simmer, but hotter.
Simmer. I got it. I'll be better. Okay. So hands-free driving law takes effect in Georgia July 1st. According to state law, as of July 1st, you can no longer use your phone while driving unless you have a hands-free setup like a Bluetooth headset. Sumaya, is this going to change your own behavior at all?
I'm not looking forward to it, but I guess I have to do what I have to do. I got my birthday was last week, and I got some AirPods, so I'm going to start using them, and it'll be a learning curve for me.
Greg, do you think it's actually going to do anything? I mean, there's been a law on the books in Georgia for a while now saying that you cannot text while drive, but I suppose the reason that was utterly or unenforceable is that an officer would have absolutely no probable cause basis to determine that you were texting with that phone, or rather than doing something else that was legal with that phone. Is this going to be easier to enforce?
No, it's still unenforceable. I've talked to several police officers, and they're like, well, we really can't tell the difference if somebody's using their GPS on their phone, which is still allowable. And I think there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences with this law, where it's going to really prey on people that can't afford the new technology. I think it's going to hurt poor communities significantly. It's going to be another excuse for police to pull people over. Uh-huh. And it is such a, just non-objective way. If it looks like you're even reaching for something in your car. So basically the law assumes that police are clairvoyant enough to say, oh, he was really reaching for his phone, and you could be reaching for anything else.
Crazy.
So I think it's going to be abused. It's a giveaway to insurance companies, law enforcement. And I do think that there's going to be some unfortunate physical manifestations of this, because it'll have more people being pulled over, more encounters with police and otherwise law abiding citizens. So I am vehemently against this law.
Wow. I need to take a second and absorb how you said vehemently just then.
Vehemently. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I'm not judging. Everything's fine.
I say it like Greg.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Oh,
vehemently. There's an H there. Yeah.
Indeed. You got to say it.
It sounds
you have
more,
no choice.
It's not a silent H.
And it sounds more vehement if you say vehemently.
I was vehement when I said that.
Or vehemently, right? You know, but the H is where the magic is. If you take out the H, it's just vehemently. It sounds like a dish.
Sounds like vermin or vehement.
Yeah, like, would you like some vehemently with rice?
I'm glad we talked about this. Natalie, real quick. Look, I don't know about you, but I've certainly nearly killed myself and others while, you know, working my phone while I was driving when I shouldn't have been. Is there not some kind of policy response to this that would be viable or legitimate?
No, I have had to scream, hang up and drive to people a lot. I mean, I do think that people they're so focused on their phones that they don't bother driving. I am confused about how it does say you can use navigation apps, but it says you cannot be holding the phone. So
I don't see how that works, because if
you'll
have
to have a cradle,
plot something. Well,
yeah. So that part, I think, is difficult. I think what it will help with is if somebody's driving like an idiot and clearly has their phone to their head, you know, it gives an officer a reason to pull the person over. I've seen a lot of teenagers, especially with this. And I think that will probably save some lives. For my part, my phone's linked in through the speaker in my car anyway. So the calling part doesn't bother me. And I'm a bad enough driver that I feel I have to concentrate on the road. So I don't tend to call while I'm driving, because I just know I'm not that good at it.
Okay, let's talk about the big juicy topic of the week. The primary election in Georgia's gubernatorial race is going to happen on this coming Tuesday. And the Republican candidates in the race have not been short on what some people would characterize as campaign stunts. Other people might characterize as legitimate expressions of policy positions. But let's listen to a couple of examples that got a lot of attention this week.
As governor, I'll stop sanctuary cities.
I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals.
We're going
to
implement my 287G deportation plan that's going to fill this bus with illegals.
So in there, we heard Brian Kemp, who is your sitting Georgia Secretary of State, who is a serious candidate for governor, serious in the sense that he might actually win, talking about his big old truck that he keeps around in case he needs to round up any criminal illegals, as he said it. Then the guy with the deportation bus is a fellow named Michael Williams, whom you would be forgiven for not having heard of until very recently. He's polling in single digits and probably won't be governor. But boy, he sure got a lot of attention this week. Wow. Okay. So, I don't know, Greg, you're a Republican. What do you think?
Well, you know, this is endemic to primary season. Apparently the pollsters and consultants have figured out that, illegal immigration and gun rights are the most important thing to Republicans. It's frustrating from my perspective because it makes us look like we're sitting around our basement full of guns waiting for an illegal to break in so we can shoot them.
And that is it does.
Absolutely not where we are as a party. I went to the first stop. I live very close to Clarkston, and that was the first stop of the deportation bus on Wednesday. So I went and I actually talked to Johnny Kaufman, who works at in NPR, and I expressed my frustration with what I look at as a gimmick. As somebody that works in the DeKalb GOP, it's my responsibility to help grow the Republican Party, and nothing prevents growth more than alienating an entire demographic of people that, and I married a South American woman as well, but I'm not a snowflake, so that part didn't necessarily offend me, but I just think we're a little more intellectual than what our ads are giving credit for right now.
Well, Michael Williams, the fellow with the bus, this is a bus that has things written on it like child molesters and drug kingpins. We're going to bring you back to Mexico, regardless of whether or not that's actually where you came from. He said that he's going to go on a tour of cities that where he can show the deleterious effect that illegal immigration is having on Georgia communities. And so also on his itinerary is Athens and Decatur. Because when you think about cities in Georgia that are deteriorating into third world hellholes, you think Decatur and Athens. Am I right, Samaya?
Wow. Wow. You know what? This is just so horrific. I mean, it's so inappropriate, not informed, and just stupid, ugly. And, you know, where did the parents of those candidates come from, or their grandparents? Weren't they immigrant at one time? Were they murderers? Were they child molesters, et cetera? We got to do better than that. And I used to be a Republican, and it's just not something that I am proud of in terms of what's going on right now.
I mean, I love the way he couldn't even spell child molester correctly.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And the fact that he...
he misspelled molesters and the bus broke down on the highway the other day.
Yeah, and he shows up in Clarkston, which has famously welcomed tens of thousands of refugees fleeing desperate situations. And I love that he got swarmed by protesters there. And I also love that he put up on his website that he's going to be doing stops at Cracker Barrels, and Cracker Barrel doesn't want him. I love it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Cracker Barrel doesn't need that. That's they're just like, no, we have no political anythings in our parking lots. God. Thank you, sir. Nimmer, as a Lebanese American, how does this all strike you?
So every time I do a radio show or a TV show in my life, people talk to me and ask me about the Middle East because as if I'm an expert. Because this is the thing. We know a truth that a few bad apples can tarnish the reputation of an entire population. You just take a look at how Muslims are portrayed in today's society, and I'm sure Sumaya would be more informed on that. But you paint an entire swath of people because of a few bad apples. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party in America both equally have identity crises going down on them right now. So you're looking at a situation where you have this nut job out there. I'm 100% sure what Greg is saying. There's a lot of good people in America, but we as the media, everybody's focusing, of course, on these stories. And that's why he's doing it, because he knows he's going to get media attention. There's no other way. It's outrageous. What I think is the biggest tragedy here isn't him, because he's an idiot. He's a complete tool. I think the biggest tragedy is that there isn't clear leadership. And I mean, everywhere. I'm not just saying this towards Republicans or Democrats. There is no clear leadership in any situation in America right now where anybody comes up and says something definitively and actually closes it down. And that's why the Republican Party is having a major PR disaster, as well as the Democratic Party. It's a mess. And on the subject of what he's saying, I mean, do you really need to put in your opinion? Why is America so focused and running campaigns on things that do not matter to the American economy in any shape, form, or manner whatsoever? None of the debates are realistic. Nobody's talking about the things that are real problems to American people on the everyday. Whether you're Republican or Democrat, you're pro-Trump, you're anti-Trump, you're completely lost. And it's just sad to see. As an Arab, I can tell you that America has become more Arab than it's ever been in its life. I'm telling you, this feels like Beirut back in 1993.
Oh, no.
And that's not something you should be proud of. Just the truth.
It's On Second Thought. We're talking about the week's news. You were just hearing there stand-up comic Nimmer, who is playing in Atlanta this weekend. Also with us is Sumaya Khalifa, Greg Williams, and Natalie Pavelski talking about the week's news. An Alpharetta, Georgia police officer has resigned after a video was released of him yelling at a 65-year-old grandmother. We're going to play it. It's not pleasant to listen to, so be forewarned.
Move away from me!
Hey! Ma'am, you're not in charge!
Another officer tried to physically force this woman from her car. Things escalated to that point when she didn't want to sign her ticket until speaking with the officer's supervisor. Now, Miss Campbell, the woman in that video, says that she just can't trust police. Natalie, what do you make of this?
Why in the world does an entire squad of officers need to manhandle
65-year-old
senior citizen woman over a minor traffic ticket violation? It was really awful to see this. I mean, it started out, if you watch the beginning of the video, the dashboard cam, it starts out normal. And then she's insisting on talking to a supervisor, and it's clear the policeman gets frustrated and he calls in other officers, and it gets just ugly. Mm-hmm. The only good thing about this is that the Alpharetta head of public safety put it out on social media and said, look, this is what happened. We don't agree with it. In the interest of transparency, look at what happened and see how we deal with it. I appreciated the response from the department. I thought the incident was just horrifying.
I agree with Natalie. They're doing an investigation, and I think that's the right thing to do for the Alpharetta Police Department. So thank you.
Yeah, this goes back to, you know, the hands-free law that's going to invite more encounters like this. And I think right now we've got a catch-22, right? Some people look at police pulling people over and saying, look, you need to pay attention. He's the law enforcement officer. Do what he says. And other folks are saying, look, they are abusing their power. We're getting shot or manhandled. So why are we going to subjugate ourselves to that? So I think, and unfortunately, these stories, they're not going away. We keep seeing them compounding. And this is right in our backyard, right? I mean, this is probably happening all over the country.
Sure,
but
yeah,
we're hearing a lot about it because Alpharetta is just 25 miles north of Atlanta and in one of our major suburbs. I don't see this going away or dissipating, and that's a real problem.
Well, the question of de-escalation, I think, is really important here. I think we keep seeing incidents where things go from something minor to
the training.
Yeah. And
the training,
where's the de-escalation?
No, the training isn't there. If you love America and you view a 65-year-old black woman as that threatening, then we should make 65-year-old black women the leaders of our country. If you have something that powerful, if you feel that that's that threatening, the actual response, if you love this nation, if you're a white supremacist, is to pretty much make those people the leaders. When somebody's shouting at an elder, no matter what skin color they are, like that, for her sitting in her car, I mean, shame on you, but... With everything going, it's clear you got a white officer. He's shouting at a black woman that's 65 years old. You're a police officer. You're not allowed to have the benefit of the doubt. You're not allowed to ever lose your cool. There are videos out there of police officers that do a great job. That should be the standard across the board. There is no allowance. If you go to the military today and somebody steps out of line, they're dishonorably discharged. There's a huge penalty because they have a zero tolerance because lives can be lost. Why do we not act that way with our police enforcement in the same manner? These things lead to loss of life because you have a black community that trusts the police less and less, and that's going to lead to loss of life. That's going to lead to less reporting. That's going to lead to less community outreach. This is a disaster, and I'm glad that they put out the video in transparency. But man, I mean, when Childish Gambino came out, you know, aka Donald Glover with This Is America, I mean, you can just play that song to this clip. You can play that song to so many of these clips, and you can't blame black communities for feeling the way they do when you see stuff like this. 65-year-old black woman, dude, Jesus Christ, get a grip.
Let's try to sneak in one related topic before the end of the show. Dr. Bernice King, civil rights icon, Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, urged people on Twitter this week to avoid the Waffle House. Quote, let's stay out of at Waffle House until the corporate office legitimately and seriously commits to one, discussion on racism, two, employee training, and three, other plans to change, and until they start to implement changes, unquote. This follows a string of controversies at some different locations of the Atlanta-based chain Waffle House. In Alabama, a black customer was tackled to the ground and arrested after refusing to pay extra for utensils. And a video posted to social media shows a black teenager in North Carolina being choked by a police officer and thrown to the ground. So, Samaya, what do you think here? Does Waffle House have a legitimate systemic problem, or these look like isolated incidents that could have happened anywhere?
It sounds like a systematic problem that needs to be addressed, and I'm glad that Dr. King is speaking out, and Waffle House will pay attention when their sales goes down.
I do think the incident in Alabama where the woman, the police were called on the woman, if you look at the surveillance video, that because we live in the age we do, you can watch the police press conference on it, you can watch the surveillance video. And candidly, based on witness statements, it looks like this woman, you know, was drunk and got stupid at a Waffle House. Mm. And I can't blame the manager for calling because she said some things about coming back with a gun. However, if you arrest everybody who shows up at Waffle House drunk and acts stupid, the jails will never be empty. Yeah. So again, yeah. I come back to this, you know, where's the discretion here? Where's the de-escalation? Where's the talking it down rather than escalating?
They're going to end up putting a Waffle House in the Garnett jail station, right? So.
Well, it's also striking because, you know, to me, I don't know about y'all, but down here in Macon, Georgia, Waffle House is, I'm not kidding, it's the most integrated place in town. Right. Yeah. It's like the one place that everyone goes to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to hear incidents like this happening at Waffle House is, I don't know, it's distressing.
But I think the question everybody really should be asking is, can you not, as a police officer, restrain a woman without having to slam her to the ground? And do you not know any techniques? Do you have no training? Are you that feeble? Are you that pathetic? It's so easy. I'm a comedian. I could restrain a man twice my size in 5 seconds. I don't need those skills. Mm. You're a police officer. This is unreal. It doesn't matter if she was in there throwing waffles at customers. There, you can pick her up and take her outside. Relax, bro. Relax. Whatever you got going on in your life, chill out. And yeah, they have a systemic problem. As soon as you have one incident, it's a systemic problem. It happened in Starbucks. Their response, there's a reason why they panicked and they ran to it. They knew what it could lead to. Mm-hmm. You got to treat every case with zero tolerance. Yep.
And we'll have to leave it there. That's stand-up comic Nimmer, who is in Atlanta to perform at the Punchline Comedy Club. We also had Samaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Greg Williams of the radio show Greg's List, and Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend.
All right. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Adam.
Bye, Adam.
Bye-bye.
That's it for our show today. It's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusa. Have yourself a great weekend.